Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter at securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
Great book, Titan, about John D.
Maybe let's start that over.
Yeah, I was just saying, after reading the book and the Broadcom acquisition of VMware, I see parallels in what I read online. Not that everything I read online is correct. Anyhow.
Wait. Are you saying that the internet isn't always correct? This can't possibly be.
Oh, ChatGPT is fixing that, though.
Especially the most recent answers that come as summaries. People love to go to Google and they read, or any search engine, and they read the first three entries and then stop looking. So what better thing to do than place false summaries generated by AI at the top of them?
They've come back and said they are
in the process of fixing those. Although one would think before putting them out, they would have fixed it.
So basically where I was going with this is what I'm seeing or hearing. And so 2023, you see this rise in ransomware again. I wouldn't ever say ransomware subtly went down. Although in 2022, with the Ukraine war starting and people getting enlisted, those in the community, security community, know that Eastern Europe, Russia, from a threat actor standpoint, very focused on ransomware. You get in talking China, Korea, Iran, a little bit different in terms of the engagement as a threat actor and what they're going after, whether it's intellectual property, et cetera. They're not as disruptive. So at the start of the Ukraine war, you saw, you know, ransomware start to go down, which people also saw, you know, there's that 3-month lag between cyber insurance, your ransomware indicators, and it kind of was tracking. 2023, you saw ransomware come back up, just surpassed business email compromise. But this year, in the first 4 or 5 months, has been a massive number of high-profile ransomware targets, impacts. And what you're seeing, or at least what I'm seeing or extrapolating from this and the way some of these attacks have been carried out is, as companies, especially large companies that have been targeted, as you've improved your defenses, as you've added in, and I'll go through the acronym checklist, the EDRs, the SIMs, everything else that you put in place, right, from a security product standpoint, built up either services from the outside, et cetera. It, from what it sounded like and what I'm seeing in talking with different groups, is that there's actually a kind of a flipper, a focus on going after some of the vulnerabilities within the hypervisor, VMware, going after cloud security instances, knowing that as companies have started moving to the cloud, their cloud security isn't as mature as maybe what their on-prem security was and their ability to do network segmentation and other things, especially larger companies as they make that move. Is that true? When we talk about the fact that there will be changes from a threat actor perspective of what they go after. Why is that? They're going to find a way in, right? Like when water hits your house, no matter how many cracks you fill, somehow water will find a way, right? And that's the threat actor perspective as well. People talk about AI like, well, no, they're using AI. Guys, your security tools have been using AI for years, right? And it's only getting better there too, right? Yeah, Eric threw up the quotations. AI. So
buzzword alert.
Yeah. But the idea is that now the focus, right, is, okay, what's the next point of entry? And when we find this, we're going to exploit it as fast as we can and in as many locations as we can. And the last month and a half, that's kind of what I'm seeing, hearing, some of the indicators popping up. And repeat offenses by the same two or three groups that are all Eastern European or Russian.
And this is, I mean, this really gets back to what we've talked about before on understanding the ebb and flow of different types of attacks, right? And if we take a macro view, this is one of the biggest issues I have with vulnerability management. We had a discussion at a dinner recently, and we were talking about the metrics going up to the board, right? One of the debates was, do you give a macro number of vulnerabilities you have in your organization, which I would argue is a meaningless number. That means
agreed.
Nothing.
Agreed. It's just a number.
Yeah. So we've started to go to, okay, how do I prioritize? What do I really care about? But in order to figure that out, that's where kind of you're at, Brian, is you have to understand the attack landscape and what's actually transpiring. Because there's been a lot of vulnerabilities that have come out that sound super bad at a high level. And then you recognize that the level to exploit them or other controls that are in place, is it really that bad? Is that really where we should be focusing our time? But on something like hypervisor, right? If you're actively seeing that in the wild, that becomes an additive metric on top of a vulnerability that says, okay, now we're seeing this in the wild. This is something we've got to take care of. But so going back real quick, I'm going to take the opposite side as you were making comments about Broadcom and VMware. And with the disclaimer, not necessarily my view, but I think as we look at it from a business practice, that the technology space has an issue. As companies start up, it's all about customer growth, customer growth, customer growth. That does not necessarily equal profitability, right? That instead of a volume-based play that I have to have exponentially more customers, it can actually be more profitable to have less bigger customers and make much more money. And I think that's actually what they're looking at, that we could buy a company, shrink the base, only go after, call it whale hunting, right? And make way more money on that. Right or wrong, it's a business practice, right? It's an opposite view that we're not used to seeing in the security space.
As much as I hate it, I think you're right. I hate it because of the way that they end up treating their customers. And the hate part is because of, yeah, people being told, okay, this thing you've depended upon is now 7 times the cost.
Now watch. My prediction now is because they're essentially shrinking market saturation of what was the ubiquitous tool out there that creates market entrance.
Absolutely.
We're going to start seeing innovation on that side and new companies come into the fold, which, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I would imagine in the long term, this hurts them, that it's a short-term cash play. But now, as you just start to get the eye of innovation going in, that you're going to have more agile companies come up that can do it better, faster, cheaper, and are going to start displacing some of their bigger customers.
Well, this isn't a new model. This isn't a new model for them because they've taken and done this with, you know, this is the same model they followed with Symantec. The same model CA used to follow. Remember Commuter Associates? Yeah. CA used to follow when they would acquire things. You bring it in, you lop off the expensive, painful lower end of your customer base.
Right.
The ones that are truly entrenched, you charge them more and they will pay because it is impossible for them to move. And they do get, you know, they get to continue on what they're working on. I think always with an eye then at that point to know that they're probably going to move off of it. Because the one thing that comes along with it is, though, that they stop innovating in that space. Like, you won't see more innovation happening out of VMware or out of material innovation out of VMware. We didn't see any more out of Symantec after that acquisition happened. People refer to, refer to CA and some case, you know, Cisco now where software goes to just linger. I think those things are real, but it is a short-term play. I don't think it's a long-term value play, but we don't live in a long-term, you know, revenue, what have you done for me over 10 years world. We live in a what have you done for me this quarter world.
Right. But the change in what you're seeing, Brian, with the increase of ransomware again, is just always interesting, right? If I look at this at a micro level, and I love tracking this on the threats, just looking at the email space, because I feel like that's one of the best areas where we can get a raw look at the type of attacks that we're seeing in the organization, right? Mm-hmm. Not to diminish other tools in our technology, but if I was to take a look at my EDR provider, well, that's kind of a lagging indicator of other controls that failed that made it to the endpoint. But looking at the email space, you can always see that ebb and flow that goes between, well, now we're high on attachments that may contain malware or has macros to pull down something. Well, now we're back to phishing links. It's just, it's interesting to watch the change in trends, and can't emphasize enough how important it is to understand those changes in the organization to adapt strategy and where you're going. And to keep going on that thread, I guess, this is one of the biggest problems I have as we think about strategy. How many companies out there that, you gotta have a strategy 3 to 5 years out? Yeah, but I don't know what next week's gonna look like. So
yeah.
How good is that?
Yeah, the attacks pivot as responses change. They're pivoting really quickly. And that's why things like ransomware are still able to be successful, why a lot of these human-based attacks are able to be successful, because we have to go through change boards and we have to wait for software to be redeveloped and we have to figure it out. But in that day zero, there's such a great opportunity to be able to exploit it. And so, yeah, you do definitely see it. And there's always more ways to exploit the path that hasn't been trailed yet.
Yeah, I go into what you said, Eric. I would agree, like on email security, yes. But what I was going to talk about was that's one space where you're seeing an increase in the use of threat actor AI, you know, and how they write an email, et cetera. But the idea of using AI in email security has been there for a while, right? So you're combating the two, right? And that's why I talked about ransomware surpassing business email compromise. Combine those two together in 2023 made up about 52.5% to 53% of all the financial impact from cybercrime, right? So if 90% to 85% of all ransomware comes through phishing and business email compromise, like it states, business email compromise, you basically got about 50% of your financial impact may or may not start in the email related threat. And like you said, it ebbs and flows with the style they go across,
right?
Because it's getting to a human, right? You need some type of credential or someone to click on something for something then bad to happen. To use a vulnerability, right? Typically they're already inside your environment, and then using another tool once they're in to be able to move laterally, gather information, et cetera. What I was going to go to too was, it's the same thing sales leaders are asking their salespeople to do. It's, guys, pick up the phone. Quit just emailing. Pick up the phone. A few years ago, that was a little bit harder for threat actors to do.
Hold on. But you know none of us actually answer our phones, right?
Right. But if I'm calling your help desk, not you, I'm not selling, meaning threat actors are being told, pick up the phone.
I thought you were talking about salespeople being told to pick up the phone.
I was. And threat actors are salespeople now, right? Like they're trying to get a sale. They're trying to close a deal, right? The deal they're trying to close is bricking your
environment. I'm working through this logic. All threat actors are salespeople. Does that also imply the reverse of that, that all salespeople are threat actors?
Or other things?
No comment. And the answer to that is no.
Joking.
To our audience, that really is my opinion. Where I'm going with that, though, is when you saw this with Scattered Spider, and it's a trend increasing. For those listening, Scattered Spider, one of the threat actor groups dubbed Scattered Spider, they literally pick up the phone, like the MGM hack, Scattered Spider, using a voice impersonation, using AI. When people post, like, the top 10 things I can use OpenAI for, in the top three, if you read them, and I'll put up this share, I just read one this morning, it was, you know, one of the things I'm glad I know about that I almost feel like I'm 100% cheating is the idea of role play, where you can put it in and say, I'd like to role play this scenario. So now you can role play if you're doing an interview, if you're doing this, like role play
Mr.
those.
Mr. Attacker, you are a bartender and I am a patron who just came in after a long day of work. Like that.
Yeah. Or like I'm in an interview with blah, blah, blah. Or I'm trying to get an admin to give me the keys to your kingdom, right? Well, here's some things you should really know. Right? Like, anyhow, using that, but then the ability to use the voice, right? To be able to articulate and use this sounding voice of this person. And I mean, let's be honest, social media, you can basically look up a company's name, put in IT security or help desk or whatever, and you'll probably get 10 people at that large company because everybody has their profile on there, says where they live. They probably posted what game they were at last week, right? Or who they got together with.
Right.
And now you have a way to make a connection. This is why pig slaughtering, you know, is a few billion dollars just out of the U.S. And for those listening too, pig slaughtering, I'm not referring to going out and cutting up a pig and having a roast. I'm referring to the little area between Myanmar and China and the ability to social engineer human beings to give you your life savings.
And I think that's that discussion of ours is in the as yet unreleased but soon to be released episode of The Great Security Debate, in which we talk at great lengths about pig slaughtering. So go back and take a look to 55 and 56 when they come out.
But isn't this kind of a problem in and of itself, and how hyper-focused we are on stopping the compromise of a human? Not saying we shouldn't put any focus there, but this is where we start getting into compensating and mitigating controls, right, that are around it. That if we start to get into—
Replace the human.
But no, I'm not saying replace the human. But if we acknowledge somebody is always going to click, somebody is going to answer the phone call, somebody is going to give up a password— that is going to happen. I'm not saying we should stop training, right? This is not binary, that defeatist attitude that because it's going to happen, we shouldn't do anything there. Mm-hmm. But as we start looking at trust models around that, all right, somebody's going to give up a password, but the only way that we allow access to where your documentation, is it in SharePoint? Where's email? Is it in Office 365? That it requires a trusted device. Now there's another level that, sure, I gave out a password. I gave out access to this, but they're missing the other piece of that, mm-hmm. that they don't have the device necessary to get in, and it becomes another barrier. And I feel like that we don't, as an industry, we don't give enough credit for some of those controls being put in place, because those aren't the sexy controls, right? That we want to sell doom and gloom on, somebody's going to get attacked. Somebody's going to get compromised. Yeah, but. But there's other ways that we can take care of it.
But, so yeah, yes to all of that. However, every one of those, I'm purposely playing the other side, every one of those additional controls adds friction. And what's the one thing, what's up?
Does it have to, though?
But this is the problem. You know, we've been talking about this for years, the five of us, the three of us, for like 5 years now, about the friction, the UX problem that security has, that privacy has. And it's not gotten any better. It has not gotten any better. Because now, think about this. If I start to layer on limitations and controls, and say, if you want to, and by the way, deep down, I really believe that this is the right answer. But you layer on the controls of I need to be in this location, on this machine, on this Wi-Fi, in order to access this thing. Oh, and have an MFA token, the right MFA token, etc. Now, layer that against a world in which these same people, not always just the security people or even the IT people, think about salespeople, think about marketing people, think about scientists that need to go do their job, and they need to, they're living in a world in which everything is made available to them everywhere all the time. Mm. And mind share, the mind share is that's the way things should operate. So they come into the office and they are hamstrung by when, where, and how they can do it. And the controls that are put in place are often done by people who don't do the job that they do. 100%. Go into a medical office. Go into the hospital. I was at U of M Hospital. This is a couple of years ago. And I just watched. And I watched the interaction between the person, the attending in the room, and the EMR. And then with the device and the medical device and connecting it up and all of this. And they had their hands full, they had an IV in their hand, and then they had to go find their MFA token. Like all of these kinds of things that are that are designed good for security, but back to the Brian's comment, which is my favorite phrase in the world, and I use it regularly, water will find its way. They're going to find a way around it. They're going to shove a shim in the door. They're going to set up their own dodgy VPN back to home and make it look like they're coming from an authorized place. So we have to, back to balance, we have to find that balance.
100% agree.
Dodgy, baby, dodgy.
And this is, I was talking to my team recently about this. I go, we are, as we make changes, there will be changes that we want to make that will introduce friction. And when we find those changes, we have to find a give as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So when we were all on the panel recently, talking about, I got the cut. So I went back, I went to our largest location. I got a big thank you afterwards. I was kind of taken back. And they go, it's nice to actually have a human being here. You had a conversation with us. You wanted to understand our operations on what's going on. You took input. And I've just kind of taken that, well, yeah, of course, that's how you do things. But that's not how all leaders interact with people, right? So we were sitting out to, we were at lunch, actually, with some of the team. And one of the guys was not able to get to email. It was triggering him that he had to enroll in Intu on his phone. And it was kind of that sigh, like, oh, I got to do this. You're going to be able to see this. I go, sure. We're putting a piece of software on your phone. Yes. Is there, I'm asking for a little of your time up front. I go, but what I'm giving you is, because that's now a trusted device, you're no longer going to get the MFA prompt every day or every 7 days, depending on what you're getting to. He goes, oh, he goes, that's great. I hate those codes. I go, and then he goes, yeah, I'll install it. And then you kind of saw the light bulb turn on to other team members. Oh, yeah, this is super easy. And I go, taking it a further step, I'll show you in the portal my personal device that's in here. Here's the software I have installed, right? I can't see anything that's personal. I can only see what is controlled by the company. So I think that transparency and finding those gives is key. Because if we continue to think like propeller heads and just push out technical controls, I agree with you, Dan. That's where the water is going to sift through. People are going to find ways around those controls that are actually probably far worse than what we were trying to mitigate in the first place. So we really have to think out the ultimate impact. And this gets into the get to the Gimba. Right? Oh,
but what you do is who you are, Eric, going down there in person, showing, explaining, right? Like having the conversation and then showing your personal advice. Like what you do, what you do part wasn't going down there. What you do, showing them that you can trust me. Look what I did. Building right. Trust is who you are. And the who you are part then makes you a trustworthy adversary, not adversary, but advocate. A trustworthy Advocate, right? I didn't mean to use the word adversary.
We're in security. We only know the word adversary.
Yeah. Now, I want to go back, Eric, when you were talking about, you know, the different controls you can put in. Dan, you talked about friction, right, et cetera. And compliant, like, I'm going to take this to automotive again, okay? 5-star crash test, right? Like, you could make the roads as safe as you want. Autonomous vehicles are going to reduce all crash down to zero because all the cars will be able to communicate to themselves. It'll be so expensive
that only the top 5%
of all of... Go ahead.
Will they communicate with the kid who jumps out between the cars and crashes all 97 of them?
They will, because the kid will be wearing a helmet that has all these sensors that actually is taking his brain waves and communicating it over. Everything you do is going to be strapped into technology, and all the NVIDIA chips will be on the helmet, the car, and everything else, and nobody will get hurt. Guess what? Dan, to your point, somebody will get hurt. 5-star crash test?
That is one of the interesting things about those. You're talking about this on the software and being people-driven, though, and people are inherently flawed and will create flawed software, right? That if we look at an autonomous vehicle without naming the manufacturer's name that actually struck a person, they started to recognize, oh, well, when we coded the AI to identify what is a human being, we identified it in the context of a person walking across a crosswalk. All of a sudden, you take the person outside of a crosswalk. Well, that's not a person anymore. So the cameras never actually saw it.
Right.
So the guys that wear stop signs on their shirt, right? And like just turn around quick.
Oh, that's a great idea. Oh, I got to do that.
So my point here is,
you're not responsible for any decisions made by anybody listening to this podcast.
Or by 100%.
But what's the difference between a 5-star crash test rating versus just building a vehicle that's compliant to NHTSA? Well, they know that no matter what, somebody's going to walk out in front of someone. Someone's going to swerve into your lane, slam on their brakes, and you're going to crash into them. So, Eric, you were saying reduce the blast radius, right? How do you reduce the blast radius? Building in features where the front of the vehicle crumples down and then taking all the different angles you could hit from the side, putting in airbag systems. But the ability to absorb energy in this vehicle and that vehicle takes two vehicles, one that stopped, one that's going 70 miles an hour, 50 miles an hour, and reduce the energy absorption down so the impact is more like 20 miles an hour. Like, right. Why when you hit a tree or a telephone pole with your car at 20 to 25 miles an hour is the car dead? Because that object doesn't absorb anything. Your entire vehicle doesn't. It takes the engine off the block. Don't know what a block is? Look it up. It's your engine. The vehicle's donezo, right? But when vehicle to vehicle with human beings in it, there's an absorption there of the energy. You're mitigating, right? Reducing the blast radius for the people inside. So how do you reduce the blast radius for the people in your company? How do you reduce the blast radius for your manufacturing OT? How do you do all that stuff, right? It's putting in not a million different point solutions, but saying, okay, how can we configure this in such a way where I know someone's going to end up clicking on something. I know some password is going to get stolen out there and somebody's going to have it, right? Someone's going to buy up someone's credential. At some point, somebody's going to come in. How do we reduce the blast radius, right? Like thinking about that from the network team and the security team working closer together, right? And you're starting to see a lot more of that in the last 2 years, right? And I won't even go into all those acronyms, but when that perimeter started to fall, right? You start to look at how am I firewalling? What is SASE, right? Not even having that conversation now from the standpoint of what is this, but looking at the network in general and saying, okay, if we did things differently, how would we do that? And then there's companies that are going through this right now that, whether it's a ransomware incident, big impact that built up, I'll call it tech debt, right? You became a behemoth over the years through acquisition. But in doing so, you ended up with X number of data centers. And they were running a hodgepodge of stuff, right? Like a bunch of really old stuff. And it was like, at one point, we're going to get rid of that, but not today. It's too costly. But then when something really bad happens, it's like, oh, wow, everything just burned to the ground. Well, now you got your reset button. But now let's start to think about the blast radius, right? Anyhow.
Tech debt?
That was a lot.
Oh, there's like nine cars, different things I want to weigh in on there. I'll start at the end. So tech debt is risk management cop-out. That's my assertion on, you know, oh, we'll just chalk it up to tech debt. Guess what? It's risk managed. It's a cop-out on risk management. We're just pushing it out. We're not really assessing it. We're just calling it tech debt, deferring it because it's too hard and going out there. I'll leave that. The other one on your I never ever thought that crash test ratings would be where the vein would come out on this one, Brian, but apparently they did.
Can you have a 5-star rating in your security environment? Like, well, you go into the board and you say, guys, we just achieved 5-star rating. And they're like, what is that? Like, nothing to do with compliance. But when this area of our business gets bricked, guess what? This area is not. Why? Because I created a crumple zone. Check it out.
But. Let's also talk about 5-star crash ratings as marketing tools, because that's a large part of what they are. And I would, unpopular opinion, equate that to ISO certifications. Doing the act, great. Help, you know, figure out what it is to do, but go and certify only if there's a business need to do so, meaning can it close deals because customers are requiring it? The certification... Right. Is otherwise just a feel good, you know. Okay, we did the work, we did the certification. If you want to confirm somebody outside and confirm it, great. But it could cost you way less to do that as an audit than to do it. Same with the 5-star crash test ratings. Just build it in. Don't go bragging about it unless you want to use it as a business differentiator.
Right.
I will agree there. That's why I was trying to keep the compliance part separate there. But at the end of the day, in order to achieve, let's remove the 5-star piece. But in order to protect the individuals in the vehicle, you had to create areas where the structural integrity of the vehicle would absorb energy and reduce the impact to the rest of the vehicle, right? Mm-hmm. It's that give or take within your business from a security controls and framework standpoint. You could do everything, right? Automotive, be TISAX, right? 2701, whatever you want, HIPAA compliance. But that doesn't mean that you created areas that are going to go ahead and ebb and flow with the water, right? Like, I was watching All Quiet on the Western Front last night, and I'd never seen it before. And it got me thinking, right? Like, when they're bailing out the water from... So what I'm referring to is in World War I, they had all those trenches, right? And they're bailing out the water. And as things are getting blown up and they run and hide inside bunkers, et cetera, you could build it as strong as you want, right? But water, like we said, is going to find a way in. But putting in controls to say, like, no matter how great this thing was built, at some point there's going to be a failure. And wherever that failure is at, if it's, you know, every 50 feet we put something in that still protects the people, then we reduce down the number of casualties. It's, I was looking at, like, watching that last night, not even knowing we were having this conversation, and just thinking about that. Like, how would have I done these trenches different, right? Like, what would have I done here, right? And it's just, I don't know why I think like that. But same thing here is, what things could you do, right? And people always say, it's not, you know, if, it's when you get breached. Yeah, but that's a selling technique. It's different salespeople use. But if you use that internally at the same thought process, right, because you are selling to your board, it's, guys, at some point, and I say guys, team, at some point something bad really could happen. What have we done to minimize the blast readings?
Right.
Right?
And this kind of gets into all breaches aren't created equal, right? That we've used that term synonymous with high dollar values that the organization is losing. But yeah, you can have a breach using the B word that is an account got popped, and but containing it to, yeah, okay, but they got this limited amount of data because they couldn't jump to anywhere else. And that's why it's become such an easy selling technique, because we've tied the word breach with, well, it cost them millions of dollars. It shut down all of these operations. So everybody is thinking worst case scenario, rather than kind of focusing on, well, we can contain the little incidents that are happening along the way. Because yes, incidents are going to happen.
Sure.
It's just, it's a fact of our lives. That's just what we do.
But when you build something, you build it to the 100-year flood, let's say. Again, based on your risk management posture, you build to that this now. Maybe not the 500-year flood, although now lately we seem to need to be able to do that.
Yeah.
But you build to the 100-year flood amount, knowing that you've got headroom in the day-to-day stuff to be able to account for that, and the chance of crossing that threshold is pretty low. So I think it is good prudence to inform, but not use it as the scare tactic and say, right, 2.4 million per incident. You say, the high is this, the average is this, we see a bunch like this, and talk to your board, talk to your leaders, talk to your business colleagues, you know, your colleagues across the organization, not like they're idiots. You know, bring them into the fold. Talk to them about the whole business case, not just the oh shit business case.
Right. But I think, I mean, yes, I agree with you on building for the big events, the 100-year flood, but also...
No, you assess. You assess for the 100-year flood. Is what you try and figure out how far along this you go.
And that's the key word, is assess, mm-hmm, right? Is actually understanding what is the impact, right? Because if we just say, all right, the 100-year flood is us giving up a million records based on this equals this dollar value, I think we miss that's probably not the best example. It's probably better to put it in terms of taking down operations, right? And understanding the technical and the physical, the business side on what is the actual impact of an event, right? Because sure, technology may go down, but as you start looking at it, you might also recognize that in manufacturing, all right, well, we also have a manual process in place that is at the end of the world. Probably not really, right? That going back to propeller head, I think you can get lost in just running your risk numbers based on the technology side and your thoughts of what the impact is rather than the actual business impact itself.
Eric, what are my two favorite words at the end of any?
It depends.
No, the other two favorite words. At the end of any metric.
See, Brian thought the same thing.
At the end of it any does. Metric. It's so what? What's the so what on the end of it? Yeah, we blocked 583 million vulnerabilities today. Our XDR is so X, it blocked all the X's that ever came in. But so what? So what? Does that mean I can sell more? Does it mean I can open new markets? Does it mean I can free up cash reserves and make them liquid? What does it mean? So what? Numbers are useless. Numbers are bullshit. Metrics are bullshit, which is why I don't bring metrics into board discussion. Again, unpopular opinion. It's a narrative about the state of the organization. It's about the threats that are coming, the things we need to do, and what security can do to enable or disable business from happening. That is modern. That's modern security leadership. It's not about, we did this, which are valuable at the lower levels, but not at the high picture.
I will challenge that a little bit, because I think, yes, I agree, metrics are BS, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't use them, because I think if you use metrics, trends are impactful. So that matters, because
trends
that
are not trends are not metrics, though.
Sure, but the trends are based on the metrics.
Yeah. Well, like I said, they're still valuable within the organization to understand benchmarking, et cetera. But at the big picture level, scary numbers don't do the deal.
Right.
And to your point on the trends, numbers, and then you were talking like plan for the 100-year, 500-year storm. But if you build to the 100-year storm or the 100-year flood or the 500-year flood, that river changes course over the span of 100, 500 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you built to what it was 500 years ago and then you have the flood 500 years later, it's like, why did it fail, right? Well, the river slightly changed course every day for 500 years to the point that, yeah, the flow was way over here, but we had built it over here and we just couldn't move it. So
this is a perfect opportunity for a Gretzky quote, I think. Brian,
what's that?
This is a perfect point for a Gretzky quote.
Was it?
Skate where the puck is going.
Yeah.
Oh, great one. Yeah. Add that up. Tee that up in there. And then to your point on vulnerabilities, when somebody has an incident, going back to the breach, right, and talking about ransomware and everything else, when someone gets to your board now and they're talking, you got an IR team in there, they're bringing in all these tools, and those tools companies, the companies of those tools are in talking to your board, and they're like, and look at, you guys had 100,000 vulnerabilities and you guys had this, right? And it's like, you need this, this, and this. And they're like, that's exactly what we need. They throw numbers out, they scare. But meanwhile, to your point, you could do a vulnerability scan. You could do a risk assessment, vulnerability assessment twice a year and come up with 10,000, 100,000 vulnerabilities. To your point, Dan, who cares? Like you said, Eric, like, but what are the ones that really matter? Right? Like, yes, right. Here's all these vulnerabilities, but this is impossible to execute in our environment the way this is done. This is not being actively exploited. And the level of how it's being used in our environment, say this, you know, if it's a hardware vulnerability, et cetera, we don't have an impact. But to be able to bubble up, right, and show like, and here's the 20 we fixed, right? And management say, but those 20 weren't in the top 10. Yeah, but the top 10 were no impact to us. Here's why these 20 were chosen, right? And what we did. Those are good numbers and trends, right? To be able to show like this one actively exploited, trending up, and we have it in our environment. We had to do something about it right away. And being able to show dependencies, right, in the organization, like now if we do the update, what does this impact further down the road to make sure that we do this right so that we're not updating something and then coming back and being like, shit, we broke everything. Now we got to fix it. Now everyone's screaming at each other. They're like, yeah, security's creating more friction again, guys. Right? Like, anyhow. Right.
Well, and that's almost, we got to look at it, that our security roadmap has to be like Wall Street, right? We're managing a quarter at the time because our risks are continually shifting and what we need to prioritize. And if we get too caught up on creating this grandiose vision on where we're going, there's no way that's where we're going to be in a year, 3 years, 5 years out. I'm not saying it's not bad to have those ideas, right? Like I've got a deck put together. I've got some things that I've lightly slighted for a couple of years out that I'd like to grow to, but that's more of a target knowing that I've got a couple other sub projects or things that we have to build out across the organization if we want to get to that. but it's always an if that is always open to change based on what we are seeing today and what's going on within the organization and the risk landscape.
Yeah, I'm doing the same thing. And in a pure agile organization, we were able to get it to reforecasting every 2 weeks with every sprint. And it was amazing and made people's heads explode. It weren't part of it. How can you plan long term for the same reason? Because we don't know where the puck is going. We have an idea of the general direction, but we know we're going to have to adjust along the way. I often use the analogy of I know I'm leaving Chicago and I'm heading for LA. Somewhere along the way in St. Louis, a road's going to be closed and I'm going to have to take an alternate. I'm not going to know that until I get there. Of course, this is all, you know, pre-Google Maps and Apple Maps and real-time everything. But, you know, you get to that point. Or you find an interesting, the world's largest ball of twine, and you decide you want to take a side road to go take a look at that. And learn and innovate and grow in it because it's an interesting thing. And you eventually make your way toward Los Angeles. Or you decide you get closer. We're in San Diego. But you have directionality. And every decision is aligned to that directionality. You don't leave Chicago thinking you're heading for LA and then mysteriously end up in Seattle.
Right.
How did I get here? That can't be part of it. But that realignment is really, really useful to stay current. Because, again, back to Brian's point a long time ago in the episode, that the pivoting, the attacking is changing. We need to be able to change with it. And this is where, you know, the idea of annual goals and OKRs really is hard. It's hard to match. You know, you can look at, again, this is where metrics come in, because the OKRs are very metrics-y, very quantified of result, but not, and the decisions you make, how do they align and help us achieve those? But planning a full year out for we're going to do the following six projects isn't realistic anymore in this. Right. And I apologize that my voice of anybody who disagrees with me is nasally and.
Going back to in the very beginning when we were talking VMware, hypervisor, and creating competition, and it'll be interesting to see what comes of it because. The same has been true in the security realm, right? Like when COVID occurred and then you had this transition to work from home and how people work created this new view of how you looked at the perimeter, right? You've seen all the firewall companies have to shift to understand the perimeter and how you could make every endpoint now a firewall, et cetera. I look at the VMware shift and I mean, I'm not throwing a company name out there, but looking at a company here in Michigan of it's not just about the hypervisor and the other aspects of VMware and data storage, but looking at network compute and storage, right? That, yeah, you could, you know, their motto, and this is specific to Verge right here. Their motto in the beginning was, well, we're somewhat cheaper, right? But that really didn't matter, right? Because to change direction and do something that different, people weren't willing to do it. But to your point now, Eric, when you disrupt something enough and shake it up, like when COVID occurred and you disrupt this, I agree with the standpoint for large business where it's when people talk about the channel and VMware says, well, we don't want to do the services behind this anymore. We're going to leave that up to our top 20 or top 100 to do the services. And they're moving all their support over there too. Yeah. If I can somewhat agree with that. It sucks, but yeah. But the small data centers were already doing the services behind it. And now what you've done is ripped out their business model. So now they have to look at doing something different. And I think if there's any good that comes from this, and hopefully these small businesses survive, but now it's them looking at saying, hey, maybe it is a time to look at how we do the network compute and storage. Before it was all about the storage piece. But now, if we really had to go back and rebuild this part of it, let's go back and look at network and compute, and maybe there's a better way to do this. And I look at the future of AI and the ability to go from 2 to 200 nodes or 2,000 nodes and how you're going to have to spin that up and down. It's only going to make more sense over here to look at doing it differently. And maybe that's one of X number of companies that are that are now going to get their shot.
Well, this is, I mean, this is to take one of your automotive analogies. This is lowering inventory in the manufacturing field, right?
Yeah.
It, essentially by lowering the water here, that now we can start to see where the rocks are, which is going to force us to pivot and force some innovation on behalf of some of those smaller companies. I want to be optimistic that what we're going to see come out of this could be some industry shifts in how we do things. There could be a big benefit. We'll see. Time will tell.
We'll see. What a great way to end it. Although I do have a hypervisor joke.
Not a joke.
More of a commentary. You know, oh, now I've completely ruined it. The idea was that in this era of grade inflation and title inflation, will the upcoming new title for supervisors actually become hypervisors? Yeah, I'm not a comedian. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Brian. Another great security debate. And thanks to you, the listener. We really, really appreciate your being here. And we couldn't do it without you. We've got a new website, distillingsecurity.com. If you aren't already aware, the Great Security Debate has joined forces with with Distilling Security. Distilling Security made up of the three of us. We're looking to branch out. And so in addition to the Great Security Debate, we've also brought MentorCore, historical episodes of MentorCore under, and we're going to start doing some events and other things. In fact, it's a great time to mention an upcoming event. It is on, if you are in the Michigan area, it is on July 18th in the Detroit area. And you can come to our website, distillingsecurity.com, and get more information about it. Brian, anything you want to share?
Yeah, no, I'm actually really excited. It'll be our first in-person event. This is more a community event. Now, I know we got listeners from all over the world, so if any of them really wanted to fly in for this particular event, that's sweet. But community event, local in the Detroit area,
it's
we're going to do a day.
On you. On, sweet, yeah. And on we're, the on the, on the traveler.
We're going to do a day over on Cass Lake. And when I say on the lake, there's a cottage over there that has a nice backyard area that we're going to be able to utilize and have a barbecue, just people getting together late afternoon, do some boat rides out on the water, and just kind of a way to enjoy the summer and get together. So more to come on that. Hit the webpage, take a look. More information, feel free to reach out to Dan, Eric, or myself.
Yep. In fact, when you go to distillingsecurity.com, fill out your email address, join the newsletter. We'll send information out about this event when it's fully available, including sign-up information, details, timing, etc. In the meantime, we will see you again on the next Great Security Debate.